15 years ago, I started a charity called Youth Excel. And my very first client was actually a girl who self-harmed. And when I came into the conference today, I noticed that she was registered as a delegate, now working as a student support worker in schools, which for many of you that have been in the industry long term know is an incredibly rewarding feeling. About 15 odd years ago, she was self-harming quite badly. She was a beautiful girl, tall, taller than me. She had blonde hair that she did this lovely little flick with. She was really quite popular at school. Her academics were absolutely fine, but she had a deep desire to harm herself. Her mum regularly strip searched her room to find razors. During that time, she would cut and she would leave pools of blood on the floor and often on her bedroom floor as well. And her mum was constantly mopping that up. To say her parents were concerned was an absolute understatement. They had no idea what had gone wrong or how, what they could do to actually fix it. Do you know, when I first took on her as a client, I actually felt like I could make a real difference. I felt like I understood the topic. I felt prepared. But what I didn't really understand is the journey that I would go on emotionally with that young lady. I realized that my empathy very soon was turning to frustration. I wasn't getting the results I was wanting with her. And I actually found myself, although I never articulate it, thinking things like this: she's just ruining her body. She's really going to regret it one day. What can possibly be so bad? She's got new Nike shoes and foiled hair. Maybe she just needs to toughen up. I'm hoping I'm resonating with someone here. I'm going to feel really bad up here. Everyone has issues. What is so dramatic? You know, I found myself thinking maybe this really is just about attention. And today, as I speak in schools and different agencies across Australia, in the corridors and in the lunchrooms, I often hear that tone of frustration resonated with professionals and educators. And I completely understand it. Self-harm remains one of those things that's actually really quite difficult to understand. And I found for myself, I actually had to make a very deliberate effort to understand self-harm. Adults that get it are usually adults who've made a really deliberate effort to get it. So for me, it took a conscious effort and an open heart to journey with young people through the experience of self-harm and really understand what was going on with them. Do you know, self-harm is simply this. It's deliberately trying to injure or hurt your body. And so many people associate self-harm with suicide. And although it's definitely not never a link, it's not necessarily, young people don't necessarily have the intention to kill themselves at the time of self-harm. Often the intention is to cope with pain or to express pain or to control pain. There's various types of self-harm. So oftentimes we think of self-harm as just cutting, but you can see here there's just a variety of self-harm. If you Google creative ways to self-harm, you'll see there's such a myriad of ways that young people actually do self-harm. I've seen young people hold their breath until they pass out. I've seen them smash fingertips with a hammer or lock them in car doors. I've seen young people scratch wounds to the point where they're leaving huge holes in their skin and it won't heal. I've seen them insert lead pencils into their skin, have rope marks around their neck where they have tried to choke themselves, and even boys jumping from heights that they know logically they can't return from without being injured. You know, one of the things I've seen as well is young people carrying around a self-harm kit filled with blades, body pins, knives, pencils, safety pins, compasses, protractors, plastic bits. And it's amazing the creative ways and instruments young people can use to self-harm. Self-harm really falls into a few categories, and this is what the research is telling us. 55-odd percent is involved with cutting, another 22 with overdosing, self-battery mean breaking or bruising parts of your body, and then a miscellaneous category there. So you can really see why when people talk about self-harm, oftentimes they do refer to it as cutting, simply because the majority of people who are self-harming and young people are actually cutting. The most common scenario that you and I will see with young people is what I say is this: scratching or cutting the skin across ways rather than diagonally here. It will be 83% of it is done at home alone. Not that many young people actually tell someone, especially an adult. So it's often something done in private. It's often done on the wrists, legs, underarms, or the crevices here. It's typically a female than a male. Drugs and alcohol are usually not involved. And young people often don't go to hospital with these incidents. And I want to say this is the typical scenario, not because it falls into the category of all young people self-harming, but simply because this. Oftentimes we're presented with parents that are incredibly worried about young people self-harming that fall into this category. And I call it more just scratches across their arms. And the scenario that many parents actually come and speak to me about is their great concern about their young person actually wanting to kill themselves. And if you look at the research, and this might be help you communicate to parents as well, is self-harm is more commonly associated with suicidal thoughts or tendencies when it is very premeditated, more than a week, when it's happened in association with drugs and alcohol, and where there is accompanying to hospital numerous times. So you can see there's a correlation sometimes with a young person who has suicide tendencies and then someone who actually doesn't. Very few of us these days don't know of a young person who has self-harmed. I know I have a 17-year-old and a 15-year-old at home, and I believe they live relatively sheltered lives. Yet they can tell me in great detail experiences where their friends have self-harmed and tried to use harm to control their emotions or express pain. If you look at the stats with self-harm, in 2015, the Mental Health of Child and Adolescent reported that about 10% of young people were self-harming. That's 186,000 young people in this category between 12 and 17 years old. It also told us that 8% of those had self-harmed in the last 12 months, and more than 60% of them had self-harmed more than four times in the past year. This is what I find particularly interesting. This is a school-based survey with 30,000 adolescents, but you look around about 80% of young people have not experienced thoughts of self-harm. But let's look at this next category. 14.6% of young people have had thoughts about self-harm, but have not acted on it. And you can see the stats on the single episodes and multiple episodes just coming in under 10% there. My greatest concern, especially with my work in schools, is this whole preventative area. If we've got about 14.6 young people thinking about self-harm but haven't acted on it yet, that's a really preventative space we can really work in. And when we talk about copycats or young people seeing someone who self-harms and then self-harming themselves, I think what's happening is this 14.6% of young people are actually getting triggered off. So they're already experiencing those feelings. They've already got those thought patterns. When you look at reasons why young people self-harm, 30% of those reasons is the last time as they saw someone else who self-harmed, which triggered them off again. So that's that area I think we can do a lot more work in supporting young people in. When you look at the male and female ratios, I find it really interesting that some of the latest research is coming up and saying that there's equal number of male to female self-harming, and I really want to put that point forward. But I do want to say this. In the clinic where I work, there's 90 families a week, and I can definitely say that I'm seeing more females than males self-harming in probably about a 2-to-1 ratio. So if you have a look at these stats here, we've got about 10% of males have thought of self-harm, yet 20% of females. We've got maybe just under 3% have self-harmed who are males, and then we've got just under 10% who have self-harmed who are females. 4.3 in their lifetime and 13.5. So it's just something to be very conscious of. Definitely males that self-harm are tending towards the self-battery a little more rather than just the cutting. I think it's really important that we understand the psychology beside self-harm and how it works. Let me give you an example. We've got a young girl who wakes up with heightened emotions. She's clearly having a bad day induced by hormones. She goes to school. She has a fight with a friend. The teenage drama escalates and her friend decides to align herself with one of her enemies and leaves her feeling very alone. She tries to find another group to accept her on that day, but finds that a little bit difficult. So she goes home feeling quite alone. She gets home, she eats, tries to bring some comfort to herself. She goes and watches television, but her feeling of being alone is actually starting to escalate. She can find herself rehearsing everything that's happened during the day. So she gets online to see what else is happening, and she sees her friend posting pictures of herself with this new girl that she's aligned herself with. Her heart starts to race, her mind starts to worry about tomorrow. She knows she's starting to get overly emotional about this, so she says, I'm going to go and take a shower. She goes, puts some music on, takes a shower, but she finds herself in the shower starting to cry. She's feeling a little bit out of control. She gets out of the shower, looks at social media again. The girl who her friend has aligned herself with is now replying and organising things for them to do together on the weekend. She goes to talk to her mum, who actually tells her to stop being silly and go and do your homework. And this girl's left in this position where her emotions are getting heightened. She did try and use some strategies to regulate herself, but nothing seemed to work. I often hear girls in that situation say to me, Michelle, someone told me that self-harm really worked. So I found myself, nothing else worked. So I actually thought I'd try it to see what would happen. Do you know, at that point when young people may try self-harm, this is what actually happens. Their thinking has gotten to a point where they're saying to themselves, I really can't cope anymore. I need to get rid of this feeling right now, or I don't know what stupid thing I might do. I feel no rescue, no hope. And when you understand teenagers, you can understand there is a little bit of teenage drama that comes into play with these things. Given some perspective of life, they realise that in a few days some of these things blow over. What is strong enough to interrupt a cycle that's escalating that quickly? When a young person cuts their arm, it actually releases endorphins. And these endorphins are released to help the body cope with pain and stress. Very similarly, if you and I went to boot camp, exercising really hard, we find that endorphins are released to help our body cope with the stress and pain of that actual exercise. Young people experience a rush or a high that actually changes the chemical state of their body. They focus on the pain and the blood, and young people tell me it's a bit of a euphoric experience, and their other problems seem to melt away into the background. They wouldn't do it if it didn't work. The relief that it really gives them is real. And after the rush, young people report a low, a numbing pain that often leads to a shutdown, an exhaustion, a crash, which throws their body into this recovery mode. And that recovery mode is actually quite a comfort for a lot of young people because it gives them a chance to catch up with themselves. There's a knock-on effect that I really want to talk to you about, and the knock-on effect is the shame and the guilt that's actually associated post-self-harming. Maybe very, very conscious of how their body feels if their arm is throbbing or their thighs are throbbing. When people go to touch them, you'll find young people tend to pull away a little bit because they're so conscious of this after throbbing, numbing, that their recovery, that their body's actually going through. The stress plus cutting relief circuit is actually wired quite quickly. It's a highly addictive behaviour for young people. It's a little bit similar to the stress plus Tim Tam equals relief for us. And in the same way, you know, when we put on a few kilos, it's okay temporarily, but as a strategy ongoingly, it's not something we always want to embrace. And because it is so addictive, I find young people that are returning to it, like research tells us, more than four times in a year, it becomes a habit very, very quickly. I had a mum come into our clinic some months ago and I noticed a bandage around one of her arms. And then I noticed some self-harm scars that were quite deep on the other side of her arm. And actually, as I learnt her story, I actually found out that she started self-harming when she was a teenager. And it was a strategy that served her quite well then, but as she grew into a mother, it was not serving her very well at all in that time. And her little six-year-old girl was at our clinic because she'd started to make big scratches through her arm. And her son was actually bashing his head against the wall when he was getting angry, to the point where he was really damaging himself. So you can really see that even though it may serve them temporarily, the long term is quite serious. Neuropathways, I'm sure you're all aware of how they're wired, but can I say this about it? What young people see really impacts what they think, what they feel, and what they do. And when it comes to self-harm, and when you look at the visual information that young people can feed themselves on this in this area, it's actually quite frightening. All you have to do is hashtag self-harm, or look up creative ways to self-harm, ways to self-harm without it really hurting, how to hide self-harm from your parents. And you'll see an array of very visible material, videos, blog videos, giving young people a lot of information that they can feed on visually, which is only reinforcing the stress plus cutting equals relief cycle. It really is normalizing self-harm to our young people and making it a very legitimate option for when they actually get stressed. I've done a lot of thinking and reading around what actually triggers self-harm and who is highest at risk. And this research that I want to refer to is the Europe study, but it was done across about 8 countries, Australia included in that. And it really talked about the very strong link between the psychological characteristics, meaning state-dependent, the correlation between anxiety and depression, and also trait-dependent. Impulsivity was a big one. So the psychological characteristics plus the combination of that with life events. And when you're looking at the combination of both of those things coming together, that's what's making young people at the most risk. This was consistent across gender and across country. So when you really look at some of the things that increase the frequency and severity of self-harm, you can see a range there of trait-dependent issues, psychological characteristics, and also life events. Within life events, let me say this, death of someone close to them or family instability rated as the 2 highest life events that was going to impact a young person's susceptibility to self-harm. I actually really want to point out that 30% of young people felt like the life event that triggered self-harm for them was seeing another friend self-harm. And I think we can really resonate with that, especially as maybe educators in schools, where we see this knock-on effect with young people. 2 motives for self-harm that I really want to point out to you is a cry for help or a cry of pain. When you see a young man possibly bashing his head against the wall or his arm against the wall until it breaks, you've got to ask yourself, what is motivating a child to do that? And research is telling us that it's not just one of these motives, it's often 2 in correlation with each other. Sometimes it can be one, but most oftentimes it's both together. So we've got 65% of young people identifying with a cry for help motive. I often read a lot of articles online about self-harm that are telling me that self-harm has got nothing to do with a young person wanting to get attention. I totally disagree with that. With a cry for help, there's often a cry for attention. It's legitimate attention, but it is a need for attention. And some of the thinking that might go in behind a cry for help is this: to show how desperate I am feeling, to frighten someone, to get my own back at someone, to find out if someone really loves me, or to get someone's attention. The second motive, the cry of pain motive, is 87% of young people identified with this cry of pain motive. And amongst that, some of the thinking was to punish myself, to get relief from a terrible state of mind. And over 70% of young people actually said they self-harm to get relief from a really terrible state of mind, those escalating emotions that they feel like they can't handle the emotional intensity anymore, which really indicates to me that our young people need to be continually taught and supported and helped to self-regulate those emotions, especially before they get to heights where they feel like they can't cope with them anymore. Time frames between a young person thinking about self-harm and acting on self-harm are actually quite interesting to me in response to how we are going to respond and work with young people. Parents will tell me they often see young people working up to an episode of self-harm. And it is very unique to every young person, but I hear parents telling me, look, they isolate themselves, they start withdrawing, they go into their room more, or they become a little bit manic or frustrated or angry. And during those periods of time, I really encourage families to find strategies, because oftentimes it's within the first hour of a young person thinking about self-harming and actually carrying that out. And if we can work with a young person through that time, they get through those heightened emotions. So 40% deciding to do so within an hour of cutting. Then we've got 22-odd% deciding to do so more than 1 hour, but less than a week. And then about just under 30% making the decision more than 1 week before. And they are the young people that are higher risk with it being associated with suicidal tendencies as well. This is a really common kind of journal activity that I see floating around the place. But when you're looking at young people thinking about self-harming up to an hour before they do so, activities like this can really teach them to self-regulate, to be aware of where they're at, and ride the wave of maybe those intense emotions and actually get through it. What we're looking for is very interesting. What I said, what we're looking for pre-self-harm and post-self-harm can be very, very different. But here are some really general things. Knowledge of others that are self-harming, or being able to give you detailed stories of another friend who's self-harming. Unexplained marks in the body, wearing long sleeves, wearing wide wristbands that might, you know, like be covering scratches on them. Difficulty expressing their emotions, secret behavior or extended times alone, items that can be used for cutting, missing, or found in their possessions in really odd places, definitely signs of depression. Self-harm is most highly linked to depression. And when I am working with a client within Youth Excel, I really do treat it very similarly to depression. Some other things I want to add is this, is blood stains. I find that is a bit of a giveaway too. Frequent stories of accidents, covering up, and fear of being touched or touching someone, because you never know what's cut underneath their skin. And young people who do self-harm have this heightened awareness of their body all the time, so that's that body consciousness. You know, as you're referring, can I please encourage you, some of you will be the referee, some of you will be the referral source, you know, but can I really encourage you to know the philosophy of the services that you are referring to and work in partnership with them? I think it's just incredibly, incredibly important. You know, ways young people, adults who refer can actually help is really a lot of common sense. I see research telling us that under 60% of young people are accessing help within a school environment, and that really encourages me that young people that are self-harming more than once or more than once in the last 12 months are often accessing referrals and support at school. But how to work with and deal with a young person that's self-harming in our everyday professions, to me, is just a lot of common sense. There's a lot of triggers with young people that kind of push kids away from you rather than push them to you. And I find if we're really conscious of those things, working with a young person who self-harms or working with any young person is actually really quite similar. So just making sure we're creating spaces of genuine empathy, having a huge amount of patience and care, and being really careful about preconceived criticisms and judgments. I find as adults, it's very easy to shame, blame, and criticize when we don't really know what else to do. And it can happen in our internal dialogue, but it also can actually slip out in our language. I've seen teachers say very humiliating things in front of other students in schools. I've seen teachers meaning well, but pulling a child over at the end of a class and talking to them directly about self-harm, such a secret, private thing, while young people are walking behind them out the door to go to the next class. So just making sure that we get our time, our place, and our tone right. Realizing that it's sometimes more important to talk about the person than the self-harm itself if we're very concerned about self-harm with a young person. I know many teachers notice scratches on kids' arms while they're working in class and know they need to make a referral. Make sure whatever you say to a young person comes from a really, really genuine place. It's done in private. You might use some language like, who can you feel comfortable talking to? I am concerned about you. You don't have to talk to me. Let's take you to someone at the school that you do feel comfortable talking to. But leaving the door open and checking in again are some really, really important things to think about. Whenever I work with a young person who's self-harming, wherever that be, I really do deal with it in a very similar way as I deal with depression. And I take very much a strengths-based approach. Oftentimes when young people first come to see me, their parents are most concerned about self-harm. But to be honest, a young person may not be ready to really talk about it as yet, and they need to build that trust and rapport first. I find it as simple as this. I think about it like a kind of a balancing act and a scale. I think when young people are self-harming, sometimes the negatives have gotten stronger than the positives in their life, and things are feeling very overwhelming for them. And over a period of time working with them, my aim is to firstly balance that scale to a neutral position and then increase the positives so they overtake the negatives. And it can be as simple as helping a child find a job, helping them discover some new interests, helping them resolve some conflict with an adult or a friend that's really bothering them, but bringing this up to a neutral mode and then really escalating that so they feel like life is worth living, problems are worth solving, and there is a future with things for them. Be really prepared to sit in heavy emotions and think replacement, think what do they do instead of self-harming. One of the strategies that I've seen used and used myself that I find works a lot is called the butterfly strategy, and you guys might already know about it. But if a young person's cutting here on their wrists, we encourage them to do a tattoo or a picture of something they really love, really respect, really resonate with there. They can even write the name of someone they really care about in that place where they usually self-harm. I find that sometimes young people will do for somebody else what they won't do for themselves. So if their mum's name is across that place where they usually self-harm and they've got a really great bond with their mum, they're going to think twice about cutting that area of their body. So I have seen that relatively successful with young people who are ready to be proactive about it. I have seen the rubber band and ice strategies. I'm not a huge fan of them. It's a milder form of hurting yourself, in my opinion, flicking a rubber band on you or rubbing ice on that area. I do give it credit for harm minimization, though, and in some cases it may be something that works. There's a really great article at helpguide.org, and it has a whole bunch of strategies. It's actually not written in your notes, but it's really worth looking up. It's got strategies if you cut to express pain and intense emotion, and then it's got a whole list of strategies. It's got strategies if you cut to calm and soothe yourself. Strategies if you feel disconnected and numb, and that's the reason why you cut. Or strategies if you cut to release tension and vent anger. So I really liked the way it categorised all the strategies that they actually were suggesting. I always try and find three distracting strategies in that lead-up period and then three comforting strategies for young people. There's an app called iCope, and it actually gives you a whole lot of strategies as well, but it encourages young people to really stop and be very self-aware. It encourages them to rate their feelings, feelings that are fleeting, feelings that are strong, and then deliberate plans to cut that they're not able to resist. If they're in the green and the yellow categories, the fleeting or strong feelings, it will take them to a list of strategies here. Everything from social, physical, creative, fun, comforting, and under each one of those headings, it will give them a range of strategies to try. Every young person is different, I find, and finding what works for a young person can be a lifesaver for them. So helping them be self-aware and self-exploratory during this time is really, really important. If they have got feelings that they are acting on, it takes them to this harm minimization area. I think this has a lot of validity for young people, realizing that if they're going to self-harm, they really do need to be taking care of their bodies and making sure that it's not getting infected. There's an area here which I'm not honestly too keen on, but it's an area where they can cut on the app their arm or burn their arm on the app. I'm actually not too keen on it because I feel like it's only reinforcing what we're trying to not reinforce with them, and I don't see that it really has helped many young people instead of self-harming. But it is there, so just be aware of that ending of that app as well. I think this 14.6% who are having thoughts of self-harming but have not self-harmed yet is definitely the space that's just so important to be aware of. We're often flagging young people who are at risk, and then seeing that young people that have got injuries on them, we're doing some intervention on them. But realizing there is quite a chunk of young people that have got these very intense thoughts going through their mind and wondering if it's actually going to help them. I would encourage you as a school, if you are a school here, to really focus on helping young people learn strategies to self-regulate and self-care. I think the opposite of self-harm is definitely self-care. And I think even though we're hesitant and cautious about talking about self-harm en masse in schools, I think one thing we need to be really conscious of doing is talking about self-care and making sure we're teaching young people those strategies to combat some of the thoughts they might be having. I know there's so many professions represented here, but for those of you that are treating your jobs more than just a paycheck and an obligation, that go out of your way to make an effort to validate young people where they're at and support them. I just thank you for all that you are doing with young people, and realise that this space is one that really needs people that care and are going to work really preventatively in helping them self-care for themselves. So thank you.